Welcome back to the podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein, and as always, this is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. It is Wednesday, August the 26th. Thank you so much for tuning in today. As always, the podcast is brought to you, brought to you by Patreon, patreon.com/themindandfitnesspodcast. Patreon is a place for creators. So if you have a favorite musician, a favorite podcast, maybe it's this one, a favorite internet radio show, a favorite cartoonist, a favorite animator, any of the arts that you can think of, they may have a Patreon page. And so if you get a lot of value out of this podcast, if you feel like this is helping you or helping people around the world, if you go to patreon.com/ The Mind and Fitness Podcast, you can volley a few bucks into the tip jar to say thank you for the show. This is a labor of love, but it also has costs that are associated. Certainly the equipment, it's not a plug-and-play USB microphone, ladies and gentlemen, is a Zoom H4n Pro recorder. I just got a brand new microphone. Hopefully it's sounding good, but I have a brand new microphone. And then, of course, all the different cables and the power outlets and all that kind of stuff, publishing fees, emails, all that kind of stuff. So a patron is somebody that is making a monthly contribution to the show. So let me give a very fresh shout out to Alyssa and Kelly, Tony, Francisco, Ashley, Michael, Mike, Victoria, Chad, Anthony, Jennifer, Eddie, Jenny, Christina, Ross, Julie, Casey, Brian, Helen, Arnie, Barb, and Kim. Thank you all so much from the bottom of my heart for making your contributions to the podcast. Some people have been doing this for a long time. Some people have given a lot of donations over the last few months. And so I am bowing to you right now and saying thank you so much for your support. We are back with an interview this week, and it has been an exciting couple of weeks in the Lindenstein house. We got a new puppy. You can find that. You can see way too many pictures of that puppy on my Instagram page, which is at Eddie Lindenstein. But you can also find them. I've put them on the Facebook group. If you're not a part of that, I encourage you to do so. And it is the Mind and Fitness Podcast, The Leaders of Pain. So if you want to get a little bit more up close and personal to the podcast, you certainly can there. Her name is Lucy. She is a 10-week-old black lab and as gorgeous can be. So we are simply in love. She is a wonderful addition to the family. On to the podcast. So Charlie Merrill is a PT out of Boulder, Colorado. And you can find him on Instagram at Charlie Merrill. Common spelling on Charlie and then M-E-R-R-I-L-L. But then also you can find him at mperformance.com. So he's out of Boulder, Colorado. And I first caught, he first caught my eye, I don't know, maybe a year or so ago, because he started posting a lot of, I think he liked something I had put out. And then I noticed that he started posting a lot of stories and posts about the mind-body connection, but from the perspective of a PT, which if you've listened to this podcast for any length of time, you've heard of Jim Prusak, who's a guy that is out of San Diego. He's a PT that is involved in this mind-body work. And Charlie is along the same type of a realm. So I'm excited for you to hear Charlie talk and come on the podcast and kind of give his perspective on a lot of things. I'd sent him over a message and I said, hey, because we recorded this podcast several weeks ago. Oftentimes when I do interviews, it's something that is done a month or more in advance. So I just asked him, hey, if there's anything that you want me to plug for the podcast, because we recorded this in June, let me know and I can put it in there. And he said, yes, he actually just put out a 2.5-hour running course that combines a warm-up, corrective exercise, and to fill fitness gaps and biometric faults, and also covers pain science and psychosocial factors for runners. So I'm going to link that in my show notes. But the link is also in his profile. So if you go to Instagram, you can find it there. He's also doing some work upcoming with Dr. Schubiner. They've done some seminars before, I believe. And so Charlie's he's awesome. It's tough to find somebody that's in manual therapy that has a knack for the pain science part of it and the psychosocial factors that go into it. Though there are not that many, there are more that are on the rise and more that I feel like are coming. So this is a really exciting interview for me to do. All my interviews are awesome, but it's so cool to be able to get the perspective of somebody that is involved in manual therapy, that is talking and valuing the same things that I talk about and value about on this podcast. So without further ado, here is Charlie Merrill.
This is the Mind and Fitness Podcast. My name is Eddie Lindenstein, and joined with me today, we're doing this over video, which nobody would know. And it's different for me because usually I'm staring off into Wonderland when I'm doing an interview. But now this is as good a face-to-face as we can get in the COVID world. Charlie Merrill, who's from Boulder, Colorado, is on the line. Charlie, can you hear me?
I can hear you. I'm here. Nice to be with you, Eddie.
Charlie is a great follow on Instagram, and actually maybe pause this episode as you're listening. And if you have Instagram, go follow him. Where can people find you?
It's at Charlie Merrill, M-E-R-R-I-L-L awesome. On Instagram.
Cool.
Yep.
And in my initial Googling of Charlie Merrill, I came up with the co-founder of Merrill Lynch, who is not you.
I definitely get trumped by him in the Google search, unfortunately.
I will tell you, though, Merrill Performance actually did come up as a hyperlink before the Wikipedia for the co-founder of Merrill Lynch. So
I'm doing well. Yeah, prominent.
Yeah, so you got that. So, Charlie, it's going to be a really unique perspective. I told him offline that I was happy to have, quote, another meathead on the line, but just meaning a guy that's into athletics and sports and that kind of thing. And I see him as a similar resource to Jim Prusak, and I get a ton of feedback from episodes that I did with Jim over a year ago. So I think that everybody's going to get a lot out of this episode with Charlie, and hopefully he enjoys his hour with me enough to maybe come back someday.
Yes, of course. I tend to like to talk, and it's really nice to see you on camera. So, you know, I could probably go for 2 hours, yeah. But you know, we'll spare everyone.
Yeah. So you're trained as a physical therapist. You see athletes, it seems like, based on what I've seen, kind of where your specialty lies. But take us back, you know, way to yesteryear when you did training, you know, because some people, they have like an initial career and then they decide they want to do something else. And then some people knew from the moment that they could think of a career what it is they wanted to do. And so how did you get into physical therapy? And then I'll jump in before we do this, but then segue into how do you get into the mind and the body and the physical therapy?
Okay. Yeah. I wish I had a more exciting story about how I got into it. Honestly, I was on sort of a pre-med path in college, and I'd had a pretty big herniated disc in my back that as I was finishing college and transitioning into deciding what I wanted to do, definitely set me on this path of wanting to go down more of a manual therapy rehab road than a medical road. Than looking down the going to medical school road. I realized I wanted to be able to work with my hands, which I love, and I wanted to be able to spend time with people and get to know them. And I was mentored by a local clinic here in Boulder and was just really inspired with how they were able to affect people and help them recover from things and improve their lives. So that was really a big draw. And that was, I think, what led me down the physical therapy road. Of course, I've always been an athlete, and I've played. I mean, you could probably try to like stump me and name a sport that I haven't played, but I definitely have a short attention span, and I like the variety of playing lots of different things. So, you know, right now it's everything from CrossFit to tennis to running, cycling, rock climbing, throwing the frisbee with my kids. I mean, I'm practicing backflips on the trampoline, and I'm just like I like to try new things, like you talking about the one wheel.
Yep.
and keep things fresh. So that's what I think got me excited to work with athletic people, athletic minded people. And ever since the beginning of my career, you know, 20 years ago, coming out of PT school, I knew I wanted to do manual therapy in a setting where I was working with an active population. And Boulder, Colorado, of course, is a great place to do that. And it's not that I don't see people, you know, I'm working with an 80-year-old that had a hip replacement right now, yeah. who's a very active, young at heart kind of person. So I see the whole spectrum of people in my practice, but because I'm in Boulder, I get a lot of these athletes. I think to answer the second part of your question, you know, I went through the first, I don't know, 12 to 15 years of my career being strict biomechanical manual therapy focused. You know, if someone came in with some pain pattern, I could collect enough data to give them a really good explanation for why I thought there was a biomechanical problem, right? And something that I could help them with and support them with.
Yep.
And I could manipulate this, needle that, work on motion, activate this muscle, you know, lengthen this other muscle, and they'd be feeling fine. And most of the time it worked well. I always had this sort of hopeful narrative. I was always sort of defaulting to reducing fear for people just because of who I am, I think. And I think that was also one reason that even if my manual therapy skills weren't the best in the world, people got better because they were good. And my relationship with my clients was really strong as I helped them to reduce fear about what was going on, just normalizing,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I got to the point where, you know, 7-ish years ago, you know, when I had my back injury, I read John Sarno's book. That was my first exposure to John Sarno. This was now, gosh, 25 years ago. And I'd always kept that stuff in the back of my mind when I was working with my clients, but I didn't really, you know, his model wasn't really clinically based. There weren't a lot of strategies in that book that clinicians could use.
Well, one thing before we're going to keep going on that, but I'm just curious, you read it after you had been trained as a PT, right?
That's a good question. I read it in the gap between when I was coming out of undergrad and when I was going to PT school.
But you have a good sense of the Western medical model, and that's what, like, so because one thing that I'm always curious about with people like you that have a background in this kind of stuff, but then they read the Sarno stuff, and to me, and maybe this isn't how the world works, but to me, I feel like you would either look at this and say, I could see that, or this is bullshit. Which camp did you fall into, if you fell into either one of them when you first read it?
No, it totally changed my perspective about what I was dealing with.
Okay.
Not because I understood it then the way I understand it now, just because it continued to sort of reinforce hopefulness and that I was going to heal and that I was going to be okay. You know, I'm a young guy with all these symptoms and you know, looking at potentially at surgery, which I never end up having. But it definitely sort of shifted me towards the safety side of things. You know, it reduced my fear a lot.
Yeah.
So I really appreciated that book. And I think that's part of the reason I carried some of those ideas into my practice without really knowing it, without being aware of it. But I realized I was missing things when I was working with athletes and people in general that I really couldn't explain with biomechanics, that I really couldn't explain the results I was getting. Couldn't attribute it just to manual therapies and corrective exercises, you know?
Yep.
That's when I started to get curious to say, I wonder if anybody has taken those ideas and has started teaching them or has made them more clinical, and how much research has come out about those ideas, you know? And that's when I went down the rabbit hole and you know, the Matrix reference, is it the red pill or the blue pill? Sometimes I forget.
Yeah.
Yeah. I went down the rabbit hole anyway.
Do you, I'm curious, do you, I want to make sure I get, I'm 99% sure I've got her name right, but let me pull her up, on the gram. Do you follow, or have you ever heard of Steph Cohen by chance?
Her name is familiar. Yeah. So I don't know her though.
So she owns a company called, there she is, Dr. Stephanie Cohen, DPT. So she's got 900,000 followers.
Wow.
So she owns a company called the Hybrid Performance Method, which was a training system that I had followed for a while. And the idea is that it's, combining the bodybuilding with the powerlifting, with the weightlifting, which weightlifting is my thing. Powerlifting, I wish I was a little bit better in, but I still wanted the aesthetics of bodybuilding. And sure. So, it's very unique. The reason I didn't continue with it is because it is an enormous time suck, 2 hours a day, 5 hours or 5 days a week. And it's just very tough to sustain that. At least at my age with my kids and just the other stuff I want to do with my time. But she is a physical therapist. And the thing that at first, when I first started following her, which was before the Sarno stuff, she would talk a lot about this biopsychosocial idea. And I was, I had big skepticism in that, especially because when I found her, I was recovering from a shoulder surgery I had, a rebuild 4 years ago. And, but then after I read the Sarno stuff and then started linking all this stuff she was saying together and looking at a lot of the things that she posts, I was thinking, oh, this is a really different breed of PT. You know, it's just a different, because to me, I feel like if you were to take 100 physical therapists today, at least the ones that I've encountered, for the most part, if you were to tell them these ideas, that they would be resistant. Am I incorrect in that? I mean, what do you think? You're in the profession.
I think we're seeing more and more physical therapists drawn to at least the idea of pain science, which I think is a really good entryway to these ideas. Clinically, I think we're really behind in having strategies to help support people, partly because we were trained in school to, just like the medical system, to find problems, to look for things that are broken, and to talk in this narrative of fixing things, which most of the time isn't really accurate. So I think we're all having to now unlearn a lot of what we learned in order to incorporate and synthesize some of these new ideas into our like more body-based practices. And that's really hard, and it's really threatening knowing that you spend all this time in school to then say that a lot of it maybe isn't helpful or isn't useful or isn't accurate or true,
yeah.
You know? That's asking a lot of any clinician.
Which I'm not like throwing shade. It's one of the things that I always say when I get, because I get a lot of emails from people, from a lot of athletes in particular that have been, you know, they almost have like felt, they have a tone of feeling cheated or defeated a little bit and seeing so many medical doctors. You know, I saw this osteopath, I saw this orthopedic doctor, I saw all this, and they kept telling me to get these injections, take these pills, whatever. But and almost as if that doctor knew this dirty little secret that they couldn't share with their patient. And I always reiterate to them that this is somebody that's probably done what they've been doing for the last 25 or 30 years, and they have seen a lot of evidence that suggests that what the stuff that they're telling you to do is correct. It would be tough, I feel like, to read a book or be told a concept and just 180 degrees reverse what it is that you're seeing. So one question I would have for you is that when I go on your website, as an example, which you can Google Merrill Performance and find it there, it seems like, I mean, there's not like a big picture of a brain and, you know, pain science and lightning bolts shooting out of a mind and all this kind of stuff. So you would never know, I feel like, from the outside. I mean, it talks about it when you say about Charlie, you can see that there's an approach mind-body-wise. But, you know, let's say you get 10 athletes that come into you with a problem. Could be whatever. It could be their ankle hurts, their knee hurts, or whatever. What percentage of those, well, actually, maybe let me back up, because you'd said clinically there's not a lot of strategies in place to do this kind of work.
Yeah.
Are there certain tests or benchmarks or something that when somebody comes in, you can sort of evaluate and say, I think this is a fully mechanical thing, like when I fell off my skateboard and busted up my ankle, or there's something a little bit deeper, or maybe there's a blend of the two. What sort of strategies do you have?
Yeah, there's a lot wrapped up in that. Where do I start? So I'm always walking this line, right, in the middle of like knowing that I'm working with a CrossFit athlete or a distance runner where it's possible that they have some body stuff. They have some tissue, you know, issues that are driving their symptoms. But everybody's on a continuum. So even though you fell off your skateboard and busted your ankle, you have some tissue damage, grade one, grade two sprain, right? Inversion sprain. But you also have the fear of, well, now what? Mm-hmm. And you also have the, what's going to happen to my weightlifting? And you know, what's going to happen with my ability to play with my kids? And what does that mean for my joint? And you know, how long is this going to take to get better? So all those fears about the pain itself are also significant, and they're going to affect your healing. You know, I've sprained my ankles a lot of times. I might be feeling better in a week or two because I just brush it off. Doesn't swell too much anymore. And I don't have a lot of those fears, but you're a first timer, right? Yep. You're a first time offender. And so that's always the worst mm-hmm. scenario. So everybody's going to have some bio, you know, body stuff and some psychosocial stuff wrapped up in what they're dealing with. So I'm walking this line always of trying to figure out where people are on that continuum. And you could even say for you, because of COVID and all the other things that are going on, there were also probably some other stressors that were sensitizing your nervous system. The way David Hanscom talks about it with cytokines and histamines and cortisol, you might have already been set up to have more of an inflammatory response than I would with that first sprain, right? So those are the factors that aren't even related to the pain that are psychological that actually have an effect on your healing from that injury.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons I don't advertise this on my website the way I could is because I feel like I want to be working right now at the front end of this problem. So we have this chronic pain epidemic. We have a lot of work to do to try to help people that are in chronic pain, to support them, to understand what's going on, and to get well, and to get back into their lives. We also have, chronic pain starts somewhere, right? It starts with an acute injury, or it starts with pain at some point in people's lives. And I want to be working on the front end of this problem, where I'm being preventive and I'm helping to get at people early to say, how can we keep this from tipping over into chronic pain later? Right.
Because at that point, doesn't it, it's surely a neuroplasticity thing. Somebody let's say I'm in my garage deadlifting this morning and I feel a back tweak or something like that, and then it doesn't get better in 3 or 4 days and I come to you. Is there any strategies where early on, because again, it seems like that you slip into the chronic spot when you hit, I don't know, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks, whatever that marker is. Because now like these neural circuits are now just spinning, and it seems like it's more difficult later on to sort of throw a stick in those spokes. Do you have people early on do things to get preventative so they don't slip into the chronic state?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, just reducing fear for people early in the process can be massive. And so if I get someone that's had back pain for 3 days, we would call that acute pain, but I'm not starting on the assumption that they did some damage or they had an injury, right? In the research, and even the way people talk about it, there's this assumption that acute pain always means soft tissue damage, and it doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we know because we don't have enough evidence or data yet to be able to say, does an acute injury that was not caused by a physical trauma light up like an ankle sprain, you know, or a real tissue damage problem, right? Or can someone that's 3 days into back pain that was caused by some psychological stressor or some life stress or moving or a change in relationship, so some of these other social stressors, does their pain light up more like a chronic pain brain early in the process? Yeah. I don't think we know that yet, but I see enough evidence in my practice that when people are coming in on day three of back pain and they have, I would say, Eddie, when I went back and did my look at my 2018 caseload of new clients, 9 out of 10 of those people had no mechanism of injury. They had no reason why their pain started. And this is in Boulder. This is in like one of the most active towns in the country. They're not coming in saying, oh yeah, Charlie, I got in a car accident, or I crashed on my bike, or I fell off my skateboard. They're like, I don't know why the pain started. I have no idea.
I just woke up with it, that kind of thing.
Woke up with it, or maybe it was this, or maybe it was that. You know, 2-3 days ago I did this, maybe it was something with my training, but there's no like clear mechanism. And this is like not like most of my clients. And so really quickly you have to start to get curious to say, if there was no physical trauma, if there was no soft tissue damage, even though we're dealing with an acute problem, is it really a body problem? Or are we needing to look at some of these psychosocial factors, and maybe those are more important? And if we can catch that really early, it doesn't take a lot of time. I mean, I've seen people come in with that like back flare up where they can hardly move, where you have to almost like help them out of the car. And an hour later, with minimal manual therapy, with just talking and reducing fear and calming people down, they walk out like nothing ever happened.
So what, God, this is really going to put you on the spot, but, and if this isn't even something you do, maybe it won't be all that relevant of a question, but I'm really curious, especially with that example of the person getting out of the car. Cause you had said 9 out of 10 people that came in 2018, it seemed like it was more here, and I'm pointing at my head, as opposed to some kind of an issue, fell off my bike. Yeah. Crashed a car, whatever. Run me through we could do some role play. Run me through like a typical interview, because that's kind of what it is, of a verbal intake. Yeah. Pretend I'm the patient. Let's say I come in and let's just go with the back, because that seems to be one of the more common ones. Or pick your poison. You tell me what you want me to have an ailment with. But what does the interview and the talking look like? You know, we can do a 3 or 4 minute sample.
Yeah. So, I start by saying, hey, when did your symptoms start? You know, when did you start noticing your back pain?
Probably like towards the end of last week.
End of last week? Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there anything that happened? Do you remember anything that significant physically that happened when it came on?
I, not really. I was in the garage and I was doing some deadlifts, and, I sort of felt something. I finished my set. I went and did my workout went okay. But an hour or two after the workout, I started to just, it's felt like it was just getting really, really tense, low back, upper butt, that kind of thing.
Okay. Starting to really tighten up on you. Mm-hmm. Did you notice any other symptoms, anything going down your leg, any numbness, tingling, any weakness, anything like that? No. It was just really tight in your back.
Real tight, yeah.
Is deadlifting something you do pretty regularly?
Yeah. I mean, usually 2 weeks don't go by without doing really heavy ones. And usually a week won't go by without doing some, you know, moderate to heavy-ish.
Yeah. So it wasn't like an outlier of a workout in that way. It was just sort of a normal routine workout.
Yep.
Yeah, got it. And deadlifting is a movement that you don't have a lot of fear around. It's something that is just a normal.
Yeah, pretty normal thing. Do it all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, right on. Okay. Do you have any history of low back pain?
No, nothing low back. No.
Okay. It's the first time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, just to step out of role play, you're sort of looking for like, is there a pattern of flare ups over time? Is there a fear of that movement to begin with? Those are things I see a lot because people fear the deadlift. They've heard stories and people, their doctors told them, don't do that movement. It's dangerous. So I like to get that out of the way, you know, really early on.
Yeah.
There might be more there, but generally I'll ask them about symptom behavior. And from symptom behavior, we can get a lot of really good information. So tell me how the symptoms are behaving. Do you find that they're reproducible? Are they really consistent, or does it sort of depend on the moment? When do you have symptoms right now?
It's, can't even predict. I it's just sort of like, it just kind of appears and then it's gone. You know, it gets, I guess radiating is not the right word. Pulsating is not really the right word, but, you know, it'll come on for 5 or 10 minutes and then it'll be gone for a couple hours and then 5 or 10 minutes again and then a couple hours. And that's kind of been how it's gone.
Okay. It seems kind of random. It doesn't seem necessarily tied to certain movements or certain times a day.
Nope.
No pattern you can identify.
No.
Does it move around at all, or is it very consistent with where it's located?
It stays pretty well in that same spot.
Okay. It's in that area. And are there any movements that really reproduce it regularly?
No, not really. There's not anything that I can, I mean, even going back and deadlifting, like, I'm hesitant to try it.
Staying light.
Yeah. But even that particular movement isn't necessarily anything that just kind of flares it up. It just sort of happens. I could be laying, I could be sitting down watching Netflix. I could be running around with my kids, whatever. It just appears.
Okay. So, you know, this could go on for a while because my intakes tend to be like a dialogue, which I really like. It's sort of a nonlinear, like emergent process of getting to know somebody. So, you know, I'll weave in like, what do you do for work? What are your other recreations? Do you have kids? You know, what's going on? So, and I start to get a sense for people, a picture of people's lives.
Yep.
But one of the questions I always come to is, so if I've ruled out that there's no obvious cause, if I start to see the symptom behavior that's not behaving like a structural problem, where I'm not seeing this typical stuff you'd see with a scary low back injury, I start to move into, so Eddie, if you go back to when this started, was there anything significant going on in your life? Was there any significant stress you're dealing with? Was there something that was like a lot of change? I'm not talking about like your baseline level of stress in your life. I'm talking about like something significant that felt out of the ordinary.
Now, because I'm going to step out of role play and we can finish that up. But I'm curious, especially at this point in time. I don't know how Colorado is. Washington was the total hotbed for COVID when this stuff began. It was something like 85% of the deaths in the month of March were 10 minutes from my house in Kirkland. And so I imagine right now, like base level stress for most people is way elevated. Homeschooling their kids, there's no childcare. They're trying to figure out how to balance work and childcare. That's how it is here. We've got two kids at home all day that were not previously home at all.
Sign is already high.
Yeah, it's already very high. And so how do you differentiate what's going on in the world right now versus whatever baseline stress would be defined 6 months ago, as an example?
Yeah, that's a good question. Some people have like these warning signs as they've gone through COVID where they're like, yeah, my back's been tight, kind of on and off. And then I did this deadlift and something happened, right? That would be more consistent with like this ongoing problem. If there wasn't any warning sign, you just happened to have it 3 months into COVID, I would still be looking for something else that was like the final straw. Yeah. Argument with your wife, kids struggling in some way, learn some news about your work. I'd still be looking for something like that. And we may have to dig a little bit to find that. But
yeah. Now, the example of the back that I had given, so this was sort of an intentional, it might have been, when would it have been? It was late last summer. I was doing something super light. I snatch all the time, probably 4 days a week. I do some kind of snatch variation. My max snatch is 200 pounds. I did a workout, a CrossFit workout that had 75 pound snatches, just a lot of them. And for whatever reason, my back was just I mean, lit up, and it lasted a long, it was like 4 weeks, like a long, long time. I didn't end up seeing anybody. A friend of mine had a very similar, she was describing things very similar. She went and saw somebody. They said it was an L4, L5 sprain, and, you know, it'll just give it a month and, you know, take a whole week off doing everything and then just slowly come back. So I just did her prescription and I was fine. after 4 weeks, I was all good. But 5 days into the COVID thing, I remember I was deadlifting in the garage and I went and did a pull. It was not a max attempt. It was a heavy-ish, might've been 85%, something like that. And I had felt like it was a sudden, just like a gripping on. And I think it was like piriformis was really sort of where it was, if you think just anatomically where it was. And I finished the workout I completed because I kept thinking like, dude, you know more about this. This is total BS. And you can think about what may have happened later on. And then when I finished the workout and I did some inventory, I was kind of like, man, you are thinking like the unsureness of your job. My job is very dependent on people being in their office, which is not a thing right now. Homeschooling in the morning, working half the day, taking care of the kids the other half. Like there was a lot. And once I sort of came to this resolution internally, that piriformis, if that's what it was, chilled out within a couple hours and it was basically done. But I like the direction that you were going. And it's exactly how I think about my aches and issues internally. And when I put myself back in the, you talked about like when you're doing that initial intake, people are having fear around something.
Always. Universal.
Cause when mine got really bad, when my issue started really cascading, it was just after I had recovered from, I had my labrum, my rotator cuff and a Hill-Sachs lesion addressed in the same surgery. And, they had estimated it would be 10 months of rehabilitation and then I'd be back to activity. I finished rehab and graduated according to my surgeon at 4 months and 29 days. He said I was like the best patient of all time. So I get cleared for this thing. And then the next day I start having sciatica, which I'd never experienced before. And then I did some stretches that I saw on YouTube. This is pre-Sarno. It all resolved. And then the back spasms started and they got really bad. And this is where a lot of fear was coming in for me. And one of the big things of the fear, and I'm curious what your thoughts on this as somebody who's a practitioner. The last thing that I would look at before I fell asleep was Googling symptoms. And the first thing I looked at when I woke up in the morning was Googling symptoms. How do you handle as a clinician, somebody that walks in and says, I Googled all these things and I think it's this and this is, there's the symptoms I have? Because sometimes, unfortunately, self-fulfilling prophecy would tell us somebody Googles, they have these pins and needle feelings and then they get, you know, it says like Google is so smart where it literally says like, here's the 7 probably most likely things you have. So then they start coming to you with all these diagnoses they think they have. I'm sure this happens
all the time.
Is it just you literally playing like, I mean, you're like shooting away enemy space invaders, which are these diagnoses? Or what do you do when somebody comes in and the internet is so easy to access?
It's a great question. I think one of the reasons I feel really fortunate to be sort of synthesizing these two things mm-hmm. and having the experience I do with the body is that I really rely on my exam skills. I really rely on my physical exam skills to be able to help people rule things out. And that's 180 degrees from how I spent the first 10 to 15 years of my career, which was how can I use these exam skills to build a case for why this is a body problem, right? So now I'm using those same exact evaluation skills to be able to say, which of these things do we actually need to look at? Which of these body problems are actually relevant? But how can we actually rule out all that stuff you read about on Google? How can I give this person confidence that those things they read on Google, which are often not accurate and scary and dangerous and worst case scenario, how can I show them through my exam that I'm going to rule that out, mm-hmm. both through our interview and through the exam? And that starts to help us build a case against whatever they were scared of at the time. Yeah. Does that make sense?
It does. And you know, not necessarily attached to that, but one thing I noticed in the background, and other people can't see this for you, is the Janet Travell, and I don't know the Simons person, what they're, but it's this is the trigger point pain pattern guide. This is something that haunted me for months and months trying to figure out my isolated issue until finally my PT said, he was sort, I wouldn't call him a mind body guy, but part of his prescription was diaphragmatic breathing 5 minutes minimum per day. And I thought, you know, I started thinking, is it a pulmonary issue that he's not telling me about? But I think it was more of a mind calming issue where he was like, I was coming in twice a week, freaked the fuck out about what was going on. And, but I bought that big blue book and I was trying to find referral patterns and all this stuff. And it seemed like either, something is wildly wrong or I happen to have 100 trigger points in all these different areas. So talk about something like that. That was at the first interview I did with Dr. Hanscom. I had taken questions from listeners. One of them had asked about trigger point injections and trigger points in general. Do they exist and what do they mean? I'm just curious on your, because he didn't address what do they mean all that much, but I know Sarno has said that basically these are highly concentrated areas of TMS. Like that's kind of the how yeah. it is that he described in one of his books. Talk to me about trigger points. What do they mean? How do they develop? Are they something that, do they resolve on their own? Do they need manual therapy? What's your experience?
Yeah, I mean, trigger points are, I think sometimes I describe them as a window into the nervous system. They're like the window to have a conversation with the brain, and they're a sign that there's some maybe local sensitivity in that area. They're normal. They exist totally pain-free a lot of the time. Sometimes the amplifier gets turned up and they get sensitive, and you know there's a local contracted band or something. People are coming to see me because they think their body, there's something wrong with their body, right? That's the starting point. So I don't want to minimize sometimes that the body and the trigger points are there. You know, there's a stiff joint. This muscle is a little inhibited, doesn't have the power it needs. Those things are really happening. But those are the result of a sensitive nervous system. Those are the result of a brain that is producing pain most of the time rather than a cause of the pain. Mm-hmm. So again, I flip that script and I can have a conversation about these things that are really happening in the body. And I want to be able to treat them because people like touch. It makes them feel safe. It's a really effective way to, at least in the short term, change people's experience. And so if I'm going to needle that trigger point, I'm going to explain it to them in a conceptualization where they understand that it's not causing their pain. It's not driving their symptoms. It's not dangerous. It's not scary. It's an opportunity for us to calm the nervous system and really create change. It's yeah. an opportunity for us to create change in the brain so that the brain is not producing symptoms, doesn't keep producing symptoms in that area. And I'll say, like, I had a client yesterday who had some fear around needling. And on one hand, I could have a client where I'm like, I feel confident it's going to help them. They've had a good experience. I'll probably use needles because I know it's going to change their pain experience. It's going to change their brain. I have another client who I think it's going to help, and I'm optimistic that it might be helpful for them, but they have enough fear that suddenly that same modality becomes dangerous to them, and it's actually going to have the opposite effect. Yep. So I may not even talk about trigger points with that client, even though they're there, because I don't want to do anything that's going to increase fear for them. And I think manual therapies could go either way for people.
Yeah. So that person, that's an example too, where they have these, you know, they have these, however they have this fear of the manual therapy, whatever modality it is that you're thinking would probably work. It sounds to me like you're saying that, you're not going to use that modality on them because if you can address the nervous system, it will resolve on its own without the need to do it. Is that accurate? Yeah.
Point will deactivate. Absolutely. I mean, you could, you know, someone like Dr. Schubiner, Howard Schubiner, or David Hanscom, if they're working on nervous system calming techniques, or I'm working on that with people, I'm either using pain science education, I'm using therapeutic writing, I'm using meditation, any of these tools that help calm people's nervous system, they're going to see a reduction in the sensitivity of that trigger point without me touching it at all. So those manual therapies are really just meant to be a temporary input to the nervous system to get things to start calming down. And of course, they can go completely dormant from one session of needling yeah. without talking about emotions and psychology at all. I mean, that does happen. But what I want to try to avoid is creating a dependency model. I don't want people to have to come see me ongoing to get their spine manipulated or their trigger points needled. I want to move away from that model of people need to depend on me, because it's just not fair to them, mm-hmm. and it's not how health is supposed to work. You know,
I've talked about her a lot on this podcast, and someday I'll actually get down there and have her on when there's not a global pandemic happening. But the doctor who had turned me on to not nervous system, not Sarno, because I later on I had told her what I was doing with the podcast and all that stuff, and I went back and actually read an email from her recently, but she's the head physician for the University of Washington Huskies football team. And I went and saw, she was my 25th doctor, and I went and I brought my imaging, my MRIs, my EMGs, my my x-rays, my ultrasound results from when, because there was all these things that were recommended. Primarily, it was like neck surgery to remove the scalenes, pec surgery to remove the pec minor, because TOS was kind of one of the main things that kept being shoved in, down my throat. Nerve lesions and seeing a neurosurgeon, like a hand surgeon, about doing some of those little micro surgeries. And then I actually went to Montana and had a what's called hydrodissection done.
Guy
sticks a big long needle along the trying to get the fibrosis or whatever off of the. So I did all this stuff, and every time I was worse. And she told me, she had asked, I mean, it was a long, usually I feel like doctors give you like 10 minutes. She gave me a ton of time. There was two straight cancellations. I got in 3 months before I was supposed to see her. And she said, tell me what, after she did all this stuff, she said, tell me what's going on in your life and tell me about stressors in your life. So that was very unique.
Good for her.
And something that was really interesting is that two referrals she made, one was for the sports psychologist that the Huskies use. And then the other one was, it was a chiropractor, but it's something that was interesting because I just kind of rolled my eyes and I was like, dude, I've seen 12 of these people. And it's like every single time they're telling me that I need to come back and go, you know, 3-4 times a week till the end of time.
Yeah.
She had told me that this guy you may see once or twice, but he's not the person to put you on the maintenance plan. She's like, I would never refer anybody out to see a chiropractor except for this one person. And so I never ended up going to see him, but I thought that was an interesting comment. So all she works with are athletes, and I haven't interviewed for this podcast. Schechter talked a little bit about an athlete's mind when he was on here, but I haven't really dived a lot into the psyche of an athlete. Jim Prusak came on. We talked about, hey, let's take questions about athletes and injuries. But mm-hmm. I would love, I mean, you've been doing this a long time. There's got to be certain characteristics mind-wise of athletes that might make them either more or less susceptible to have these sudden pain issues pop up. You said in 2018, 90% of people are coming in. There's an indescribable issue. Just talk about an athlete's frame of mind. And why is it that an athlete would have a long-going issue when it shouldn't be there? I mean, like, because the big negative is that we're wildly aware of our body, right? We use it all the time. And so if something fundamentally just feels a little bit different, I feel like we're like a hawk. We can notice it really, really easily.
Yeah. We're vigilant. We have a hypervigilance.
Yeah. 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 So just talk about the athlete's frame of mind.
Athletes are absolutely more prone to having pain in the body that's generated by psychological and social processes. They're absolutely as likely, if not more likely, to have that experience. And I think as athletes, we always assume that we're overtraining or we're pushing ourselves too hard or our bodies can't handle it. And there are so many examples to the contrary of the human body's ability to tolerate work, heavy work, you know, weightlifting, endurance training. You know, I mean, we see examples of people's bodies doing amazing things, but we're the first ones to say, well, I must be overdoing it, or I should do less of that, or I should rest, right? My experience is that when that happens, it's possible that athlete is burnt out, or they have too many other things going on in their lives that are making them unmotivated to do that sport, or it's time for them to create some change in the sport, the way they're engaging in that sport. And those psychological processes are more likely to cause symptoms than the actual volume itself, right? And this is because, well, I'll go back. I think one reason that athletes are sensitive to pain is because they rely on their body to do whatever sport they're doing. Mm-hmm. So if your brain wants to get your attention, the first thing it's going to do is give you pain in your body, right? It's foolproof.
Yep.
Right away, it's going to create fear for people. And while there's always a helpful message there, it's not always clear what the message is, especially if we're assuming that it's our training and our sport that's the problem. Mm-hmm. So we already have a heightened level of sensitivity, as you said, to the body. We also tend to have some of these personality traits that we know point towards what John Sarno would call TMS or mind-body syndrome or whatever. And I have to say, like, I don't like to make this a dichotomy. I don't like to make it a, some people have this diagnosis in quotes and other people don't. This is just like a universal human experience, right? We're learning now this happens to everybody. And so when you take an athlete who is high achieving, right, they're perfectionistic, they're putting a lot of pressure on themselves, they're probably achieving in many aspects of their lives, they're often overloaded, they're maybe using sports as a way to improve their self-esteem or to prove something to themselves or to others, and you take that person and, you know, it's going to be much more likely that they're going to have symptoms than someone that's not in that scenario, that's not that, that personality style. You then layer on top of that the fear of losing your community, losing your ability to do the things you want to do, sort of the consequences around the pain itself. Mm-hmm. And you're sort of setting yourself up for a perfect storm in that way. So now you have the fear of the pain itself, and you also have all the other stressors that are going on around that sport. I mean, I've seen a lot of people that they're even continuing to do, let's say, train for Ironman after doing 15 Ironman distance races. And you can tell they're just not, their heart's not in it anymore.
Yep.
But it's so much a part of their identity. It's so much a part of the fabric of their life that they just can't let it go. Mm-hmm. And you can tell there's time for them to make a change for whatever reason. But they're putting pressure on themselves. They're being hard on themselves. They're being judgmental. Maybe their race performance is suffering. And you just see this spiral of psychological processes that leads to injury after injury after injury. Now I have plantar fasciitis. Now my knee hurts. Now it's my hip. Now it's my back. And you start to see it move around. Yeah. And there's that symptom behavior again that points away from a body problem and really points more to some of these other psychosocial factors. So you really... athletes don't want to hear that a lot. They really don't. In the moment, especially, they're fighting against this, right? They don't want to hear.
The example of tied up in the identity, the Ironman one, is so perfect. Especially like in my life, like I like weightlifting a lot. When the pandemic started and all the gyms were shut down, I was still trying to write myself a really hardcore weightlifting program where I'd squat every day and I'd do a heavy pull every day and I would do a lift every day and I would do accessory every day. But then, like, you know, my knees would get achy and my all this, and I just kept thinking, like, gosh, like, is it too much weight? Am I working off the wrong maxes? All this kind of stuff. And then I had just sort of thought, like, no, dude, like, this is a good opportunity to have like an off season, basically, and start tying in some more stuff, do a little bit more of the CrossFit stuff, go learn a new hobby, hence the longboard, which parlayed into the one wheel.
I'm very impressed with your butterfly pull-ups, by the way. I saw a video.
Oh, okay.
Very smooth.
That is one thing that, despite having a shoulder reconstruction surgery, when I hear people say like, oh, you're going to get hurt with that, I'm like, dude, I've had my shoulder completely rebuilt. I've got multiple anchors in there, and I'm like, my mobility is still fine. Like, I know, I don't have any issues there. But I think that finding a new outlet is totally okay, and so that's how I've treated weightlifting. I sprinkle a little bit here and there, and I do my you know 20 or 30 minutes of metabolic conditioning stuff. But then it's like, I want to go get a long walk. I want to go take a hike. I want to go ride my one wheel. I want to go ride my bicycle with my daughter. I want to go ride my motorcycle in the dirt. Like, there's all this stuff that I want to do. And for months I was sort of trying to keep pushing and saying, I'm the weightlifting guy. I have been for the last 6 years. And like, this is what I'm going to do. And it's, to me, if you were to ask me, are you doing it for everybody else? No. However, there is this persona of like, this is who I am, but it doesn't have to be that way.
Well, it's okay, right? It's okay. I love what you said about taking an off season. There's so many sports. Weightlifting's one, CrossFit is one, rock climbing's one. There's so many sports where there really isn't an off season. You could do it year round.
Yep.
And I don't think our brain likes that. I think even secretly we like novelty enough that we need to put that thing away for a little while and trust that that's actually going to make us better as athletes rather than affect our performance negatively, right? We need to give ourselves permission to take a break and to put it away, because that's what year after year starts to actually build the most fitness. Mm-hmm. But it's scary to do that. right? Yep. It's hard to think that maybe I need to give that a rest for a part of the season or whatever. The other thing we see with athletes is that exercise becomes a really great strategy, or seems like a really great strategy, to manage anxiety and to manage some of these big emotions, whether it's anger, or grief, or sadness. We tap into exercise, we tap into movement as a way to help us cope with those things. And it can be very effective. I think it's less effective if we're not aware of the fact that we're doing that. If we can go into a weightlifting session with some intention around processing anger, and we're going to use that snatch workout to be able to burn off really intentionally some of the anger we have about a specific situation. I use that in the gym all the time. If we're just using it because we're angry and it's our distraction, that's less helpful because the anger doesn't actually go anywhere. But one thing we know about athletes is if it's our one strategy for managing emotions and for managing anxiety, and our brain decides to make pain and we lose our ability to do that activity, what do we have left? Right.
So that you just said something that's really curious to me, because I see it a lot. There's a lot of people that I follow on Instagram that I know, some of them close to, some of them that I'm not, but the messaging seems consistent, and it's something along the lines of like a video of them lifting or doing a workout or something. And the explanation of, you know, in the past few months, the gym has been closed and it's really been bad for my mental health, or my depression has been at an all-time high, and so I'm going to go in the gym and lift. I want you to go a little bit further in that, because you did comment on it a little bit, but like using, because that has a really different connotation to me than like you had said, I had a really shit, because I remember once writing on a social media post years ago, I had a really shitty day. It was the last day of the month for a salesperson, all this kind of stuff. So I picked today to kill today's workout, and you know, that's just is what it is. To me, that has a really different message than my depression has been through the roof lately, so I'm going to go and lift or whatever. To me, they just feel very different. It's a very temporary thing versus a very dependent issue. It sounds to me like if somebody says my depression or my anxiety has been an all-time high and I need the gym in order to sort of balance that. To me, it's really no different than walking. I mean, I guess it's a little different, but like if I walk into the gym and I crack, or I walk open into the fridge and crack open a Jack Daniels and mix it with something to help me out with the depression I've been feeling lately, they seem very similar. Can you comment on that?
They are. They're exactly the same. They're, you know, exercise can be defined, and especially in Boulder where I live, this is a big issue. Like exercise becomes an addictive. It's just like drinking alcohol or using drugs. And it doesn't have to be, but that's how it shows up in people's lives a lot of the time, where it's a coping strategy and it is a distraction, like those other substances, to the big emotions that we're feeling. And if we're not looking at those emotions and we're just using it as a distraction, they don't go anywhere, as I said. If we can build the skill of attending to our emotions, remembering that they're not scary, and actually repressing them is actually more dangerous than expressing them or feeling them. If we can understand that, then we can use our exercise as a tool, as an effective tool, to be able to process those emotions.
So right? what are some of your more favorite strategies to deal with those that you make recommendations for?
You mean movement strategies?
Dealing with the emotions.
Oh, dealing with the emotions. Well, you know, the steps are like, first you need to give yourself the space and permission to identify what's going on for you. You know, sometimes I'll just have people put their hand to their heart, because that really, the research shows that helps you get in touch with what you're feeling and say, what's going on for me? What do I need right now? Right? Exercise is the default, or alcohol is the default, but you're trying to identify what's going on for me. What am I feeling? Anxiety is the surface emotion, but really what's underneath the anxiety? You know, you can identify the situation or the person, and then you can try to label the emotion that's there. And you can explore that a little bit, right? You can see this takes some doing. It's a skill that you have to build. And I use writing a lot to help people do that. I help them facilitate it. I encourage them to talk with their family and friends to help to make those connections. And then the processing, after you've explored it so you understand it a bit, the processing you can do in lots of different ways. And movement is a great way. So I'll take someone in the gym and we'll use a slam ball. And we'll visualize the situation or the person, and we'll use that slam ball to express that anger that they're feeling in that situation, right? we'll take that ball and we'll smash it against the ground, or we'll take it and we'll throw it as far as we can to get it away from us, right? And then we'll walk away from it. So there's the opportunity with all these CrossFit movements, especially these gym-based movements, to express anger very intentionally. And at the end of this, people end up in tears. I mean, they'll just stop the movement altogether and they'll just be crying. They've moved from anger to sadness, mm-hmm. and they move from sadness to hopefully towards compassion for themselves or to forgiveness. And there's a conversation that happens around that. Sometimes it needs to be facilitated. But, you know, I'll go out on an hour-long bike ride when I'm feeling really frustrated with something, let's say, and I'll just go out with the intention just to put so much power through the pedals, you know, and burn that rage or that anger. Anger is one of the hardest emotions. It's one of the scariest. We all have it. Most of us repress it, and it causes problems. So if I can call up and visualize what's going on for me in my life, and I can express that on the bike, I come home feeling really different.
There was two things that you just said that, like, literally, it wasn't goosebumps. It was like I had that lump in my throat where it was like, this is really profound stuff. The first one was the hand on the heart. Even just me thinking about putting my hand on my heart and thinking about life, something shifts. You know what I mean? Like, something shifted. Yeah. I could feel something. Sure. The other one was people will finish an exercise like a, you know, ball slams or whatever, which. Rarely do I hear people bring that up, and I probably do them 3 times a week just because I don't know if it's the sensation of loving to throw that heavy ass ball down on the ground as hard as I can, or the fact that it's something I can do where the kids are asleep in the room right above me and it makes really no noise and I never have to worry about somebody waking up and being like, why'd you wake me up, that kind of thing. But breaking down after after this intense moment like that, I mean, I even remember years ago, this was way pre-Sarno, nothing hurt. But there's a day, and it's coming up here, July 22nd. I've actually got it tattooed on my right arm. But when I was a little kid, into my teen years, into my later teen years, I was very overweight. I was 100 pounds overweight, and, exercise became my thing, but there was a lot of hurt there that I remember the therapist I work with, or the psychologist I worked with right after I read Sarno's book. He had, you know, related a lot of hurt and repressed hurt to being very overweight and being made fun of a lot as a little kid and just experiencing not being able to keep up or not being able to do certain things, or even just like, you know, in middle and high school, people pointing out the fact that I'm look a lot different than them. So I've got, it's a picture, it's a tattoo of a grave. I told the tattoo artist, I said, here's my idea. Tell me, you know, you can freehand it. I trust you, which is a, that thing could have looked like anything. But I'd said, think about the elephant graveyard in The Lion King. So that's sort of the backdrop I want. And then I want like a grave that has the date of the first day I ever stepped in a gym, which was July 22nd, 2002. And so really most of the time I will pick the hardest workout I can possibly think of where it's sort of like, this is the anniversary day. So remember I did Murph. This is probably 2013 or 2014. I did Murph, which for those of you who are listening that don't know what it is, you run for a mile and then you do 100 pull-ups and then you do 200 push-ups and then you do 300 squats and then you run another mile. And I did it in 34 minutes. And I remember when I finished it, I laid on the floor in a puddle of sweat, but I also started crying really heavily and never knew why until the last couple of years. And thinking about like, you just had like this emotional overload moment. And I started thinking, I was telling a friend of mine who's a massage therapist about this not long ago. She'd said, it's not uncommon for her to do manual therapy on people and they start crying in a session. She never asked why, you know, what are you crying about and that kind of stuff. Cause she knows like something was related to, you know, they thought about something. I was on this part of the tissue, something resolved, something happened, like that kind of thing. And I just thought like, it's such an interesting mind-body system that I feel like a lot of people will fly through the radar the rest of their lives and they will never have that gift that you're talking about right here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, you know, it's like deep work for me. Like it's so meaningful and the stories I hear are so poignant and it just, I don't know. It's just, it's so powerful. As you know, when you start to see things in a new way and see the possibilities that that time marker idea that you just described is so powerful, because right there, you may not even be aware of it, but there's so much emotion around that date for you, and your ability then to go and do something that really, I don't know, does honor or celebrates that first date you stepped in the gym is so beautiful, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know what the emotion was that came up for you. Maybe you could speak to that.
It was 6-7 years ago. So I don't know what it was at the time, because it just happened and I don't know why it happened.
It's you.
Yeah. It just happened.
Interesting to explore that. But if you're okay, I just want to end with a quick story to sort of tie some of this back together, about how important this work is, because we talked a bit at the beginning about acute pain and how this has to start somewhere. And how we want to try to catch it early. We talked about the low back being one of the common areas, although I see this with all parts of the body. It's not just isolated to the low back. It's all the common diagnoses, you know, plantar fasciitis, neck pain, patellofemoral issues, you know, lateral elbow pain in climbers. I mean, the pain's going to go where it's going to get that athlete's attention. The brain is smart.
Yep.
How am I going to get this climber's attention? Well, I'm going to give him finger pain and I'm going to give him elbow pain. Mm-hmm. Right. Anyway, talking about time markers, I saw this client a few years ago, and he came in a few weeks after the Christmas holiday with back pain that hadn't gone away. It was like 2 weeks into it. So it was still kind of in the acute, subacute phase. And he'd had back pain before. It had kind of been on and off. But the first thing you're thinking was, well, Christmas holiday, like, that's always a stressful time for people, often a stressful time for people. There must have been something going on around that time. And he couldn't identify it. But the way he hurt his back was he was pushing light snow off the sidewalk, just like gentle pushing off the sidewalk, like 2 weeks before Christmas. Mm-hmm. And his back just went out, right? Out of nowhere. He's on the ground. His wife had to come out and help him. He couldn't get off the ground. It was that like 10 out of 10 pain flare up. Yep. And I have to say, like, most of the time, those 10 out of 10 back pain flare ups are totally benign. Mm-hmm. Harmless, which most people don't know, and I love explaining that to people. So he got a little bit better, but he was still really struggling. And we talked about the interview, you're going through the interview, and the symptom behavior is kind of weird. It's not really lining up. He's got muscle tension, but the pain behavior is odd. And he wasn't finding something around the time of the holidays that he could use to explain why his back pain flared up. And I said, hey, I'm just curious. Time markers sometimes are really important to think about when your back pain flares up like this, seemingly out of nowhere. I said, if you can just think for a second about, was there anything significant from an anniversary perspective about that time? And he sits back in the chair and he crosses his arms and he thinks about it for a second. He said, you know, it's really funny you asked that. He said, I hadn't thought of this, but both my parents passed away on around that like 1 or 2 or 3 day time a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And I guess I hadn't been aware that there was a lot of emotion coming up for me about both my parents passing away. I mean, you know, losing a parent is really hard. Yep. The grief is really hard. And he'd lost both of his parents, but as he's pushing this snow off the sidewalk, he wasn't aware that that was coming up for him, that time mark was coming up for him. So you can see this divergence point where very quickly you could say, well, this guy has a back injury. He was shoveling snow and I need to work on his body because his hamstrings are tight and his core is weak and he's not shoveling right. Versus this guy's had some big grief. And we need to be sort of looking at that piece of the puzzle for him. And if you don't make that connection, there's not much to talk about, right?
Yep.
And so for him, just making that connection 2 weeks after his injury was enough to very quickly shift his experience with his body. He had less fear. I ruled out his body, did an exam, talked about his parents, talked about his grief, encouraged him to do some writing, write a letter to his parents that he was thinking of them.
That's,
you know,
awesome. Yeah.
We're going to send it. But he, you know, in a few days, he's fine and he'll never have chronic pain.
You know, one thing that makes me think of, when I think about situations like that, where you're using like a time marker, is there ever any concern, or what would be your commentary around, I don't know if you've talked to him since, but when he gets to that point of time during the course of the next year or the next year or the next year, what if there's some inherent fear that like, oh, we're at that time of the year and something's going to happen? Like, do you find that people would generally go that route, or is it more like it, whatever happens, happens? Because that's kind of where I'm at now, is like, whatever happens, happens. But a lot of people may not be, they're not entrenched. They haven't done 135 podcasts on one topic. So, so like, would there be any concern around somebody then approaching those time markers and thinking, oh, something bad's going to happen?
That's a good question. Is there anxiety? I mean, that becomes a conditioned response, right? Then that time of the year becomes linked to back pain. And sometimes you do have to work hard to unlink those two things. My experience is most people, once they're aware of it, and they can approach that time of year with a different intention, the pain's no longer necessary. Mm-hmm. There's no need for the message from the brain, right?
There's two things that came to mind too. For the longest time, I never understood why in March, June, September, and December every year, I got some kind of a knee or a sickness issue. And then put two and two together when I was making my inventory of, here's the symptom, here's the date it happened, or the approximate. And determine, okay, I've been in sales for 10 years and that's the end of every quarter. Within 3 days of the end of every quarter, like clockwork. Right. Yeah, every quarter for 10 years, that's 40 times there was an issue. Was interesting. The other thing about having your attention, you're talking about the climbers earlier with the fingers and the elbow. Yeah. The first time that somebody came on the podcast to talk about that was Schubiner. And I had told him about, you know, I had my shoulder surgery and then it seemed like I was recovered. And then all these spasms start to happen and it's into my traps and I can't feel my fingers and I'm getting the electrical signals down my arms. And it's like, well, what do you like to do? You know, what are some of your favorite things to do? I'm like, I ride a motorcycle. I do weightlifting. I do CrossFit. He goes, could you do those things with what was hurting? And I said, no, absolutely not. He's like, does it have your attention? And I was thinking, whoa, right? Like how crazy that is, but it's totally the case. And it sucks double for athletes because they're, again, if they've become codependent on being able to do this thing to level out all the other shit in their life, and then they can't, like, what can they focus on? And if they don't know about this stuff, they will just focus on that injury, unfortunately.
For sure. I mean, there's always pain is always a helpful message. Even your ankle sprain off the skateboard, if we really dug into that and took a look at it, there's some helpful message for you in that you may not recognize till later. Mm-hmm. So even an injury, I like to be consistent with that. But all these symptoms are just a helpful message from our brain to try to get our attention. They're pinging us to say, what's going on for you, Charlie? What's going on for you, Eddie? And if you can figure out the message quickly, the symptoms are no longer necessary.
Yep.
And you move on, you know?
Yeah. I mean, people that I know that I feel comfortable enough making this comparison, but if there's some sort of an implication around the sensitivity of the body and the body is fragile, the first thought I have is go to the grocery store, go buy a steak and just try and tear the steak with your bare hands, or try and do something to manipulate that tissue and actually break it apart. I'm like, it can't be done. So there's no way that it's as sensitive as you think it is.
I love that. So, I've heard of that before.
And by the way, that cow, by the way, is a vegan or a vegetarian. And
nice.
So
point made, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, that tissue is so durable. We're so hard to break. It takes a lot to break us. And most of the time when we have symptoms, even as athletes, our body is fine. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'll evaluate people and I'll find stuff, but if those findings aren't lining up into a pattern that points to some tissue problem, we're talking about this other stuff, you know?
And the last clarification was, if you are evaluating somebody and there is some tissue stuff, I mean, to you for the most part, and let's say the majority of the time, 99%, whatever number we want to use, is it, yes, there is some stuff, but time will heal and there doesn't have to be this big. Because I think a lot of people just go like, oh, if it's a medical thing, then I need to go have surgery, or I need to go do this. I need to go do that. And the thing that Jim Prusak kept saying with my ankle is like, just give it time, man. Like, it's fine. Like, it'll be good.
Yeah. I spend a lot of time explaining to people how the body heals and how we know that tissue heals in a very predictable, somewhat linear way. And we can count on it. Like, we can trust that our body's going to heal itself in this amount of time. And, but the pain often sticks around, as you know, way longer than it needs to, usually because of fear and other life stress factors. But if people can trust that their body's going to heal and they can stay active during that process instead of resting, mm-hmm. right? We know that movement is actually healing for people. So I, I, I really help them understand that you need to be moving. Let's figure out ways to get you moving that don't feel threatening, that don't feel painful, because that's actually going to make you heal better, and give them permission to do that. Then they do really well. I see plenty of people that have real soft tissue injuries or come out of surgery. I mean, yeah, that happens too. And so then the conversation is reducing fear around the body, helping them trust that their body's going to heal, and keeping them active.
Yep.
And also talking about some of the other psychosocial factors that are in parallel with that to make sure that the pain goes away as quickly as possible.
Charlie, we are at the end here. This was a quick hour. Where can people find you? You did the Instagram earlier. You got a website. If they're in Boulder and they're listening to this, give us some plugs.
Yeah. Thanks for asking. Mperformance.com. The M is in Merrill, my last name, is my website. It's not the most robust website in the world. I think my biggest channel right now is my YouTube channel.
Oh.
I believe it's Merrill Performance Boulder. I have tons of videos on there. The majority of them are body-oriented, corrective exercise-based stuff to help people, you know, help themselves. It's all free right now. And more I'm starting to weave in and synthesize some of these other ideas. I'm getting brave enough to talk about it to my YouTube community and really trying to figure out how I can best do both. Like, let's talk about the body and what you can do for the body, because that changes the brain.
Yeah.
Let's also talk about the other stuff. And I think that's, it's challenging to do, but I'm doing more of it. So check me out there. I think it's Merrill Performance Boulder.
Yeah. I typed in Merrill Performance and there's almost 200 videos on there. So I just subscribed and I'm gonna check out some of this stuff later.
Thanks,
so,
man. Yeah. Working on.
All right, Charlie. Thanks so much, man. I really appreciate your time.
Yeah. It's really nice to talk to you, Eddie. Hopefully we can talk again at some point. Stay in touch.
Welcome back to the podcast. I am your host, Eddie Lindenstein, and as always, this is the Mind and Fitness Podcast.